Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, please sit back because you are now about to go behind the blue curtain.
Lord, good morning. Morning. That means it's time to go behind the blue curtain. I'm your host, Stan Mason. Once again, for all of you tuning in for the first time, this is not a black show, white show, cop show, Christian show, Muslim show, gay show, straight show. This is our show. On this show, we focus on the problems that all the other media doesn't want to talk about. On this show, you guys are allowed to call in. The call-in number is 646-716-4621. And when you call in here, you're on. You're not limited to 10 seconds and you're out the door. Some of you say, well, I understand what he's saying. I want to say something, but I don't know how to say it. If you've been through some stuff, you say it like you lived it, because you're going to make a lot more sense than those who just read about it. On here, the least are the experts on the conditions that we're talking about. Just a warning up front, you may hear some expletives or colorful metaphors, also known as swear words. We're going to keep the N-word is a no-no, the C-word is a no-no, the B-word is a no-no, and no F-bombs, you know. Let's try to keep it as clean as we can. This is not your grandfather's radio station. People are going to call up here, and they're going to speak with passion. Don't mistake their passion for anger. Some folks have just been through some stuff, you know, and I'm glad to give them that vehicle where they can come here and express themselves, and it may stop them from going out and doing something stupid. So everybody's opinion is welcome here. I'm not the end-all, be-all, say-all. You know, I look up things that I know, and all of my opinions are based upon what I've experienced and what I've lived through. And, you know, some of the things I've seen as a police officer. I don't speak for the city of Waco, the Waco Police Department, the officers, civilian employees, and citizens of Waco. Everything I say is my personal opinion. With that, we're going to get started. I'm going to start off with that video that's going around on Facebook about the traffic stop. I'm going to hold off judgment on it until I can find out if it is accurate and real or if it's not. I've got it up on my page. You guys can go look at it. You can make your own determination as to whether it is or isn't. If it is, we'll know shortly. That's for sure the way things are going right now in the current climate. Okay, what I wanted to do is one of the questions I get asked the most is, what is it like being black and being a police officer in today's climate? So that's kind of the topic. And in it, when you guys, you're welcome to call in, because I want to hear from you guys as the things that you see black officers doing that are good in the community and things you wish they would do more of. You know, I'm not going to come on here and try to speak for all black officers. I can only speak for me, how I see things and my perspective of it. If there's any officers out there, don't be trying to come up later. Well, you don't speak for all black officers. You can pick up the phone and call in to speak for yourself. I'm not going to put you on blast. Okay. But before I go into that, you know, I was thinking about something earlier this week, and you guys, you can weigh on this too. This is kind of be a side topic. You know, I thought about it. I said, you know, if I was found in the park hanging from a tree with a Confederate flag tied around my waist, there'd probably be people from all over that don't even know me that would come here and they'd march and protest and we'd have a big to-do. But if I'm shot by some brother on the street, chances are there probably wouldn't be a march. Now, I'm still dead. The only thing that has changed is the color of the person that killed me. Now let's move over and go to white folks now, or white people, whatever term you want to use. When somebody can rent a penthouse and rain down fire and kill 50-some-odd people, there was some anger, but not that much outrage. Now, if somebody Hispanic kills one white person, there's outrage all the way up. to the White House. What's the difference? Somebody is still dead. Now let's go one more step further. Let's go to the police, to the blue culture. We see murder, aggravated assaults. We see the worst that society has to offer. Yes, it's our job. Yes, we see it. We move on and we function. But a lot of times we don't give this stuff a second thought. We're moving to the next call. Till it's one of us, then we get outraged. And we wonder why our court system is so jacked up. It's because we're jacked up. We'll look at the act, the murder, and before we even, and some of y'all, we do it on Facebook, before we make a comment, we just got to know, was this guy black or white that did the act? Then we gauge our comment by that. And what I'm saying is, until all of us sit down and the race thing is secondary. Let's deal with the act, because if we can't separate that out, that's one of the reasons why some folks get probation and some folks are getting jail. Because we all got to come together and look at it for what it is, and then if there's a race issue to it, then we attach that to it and get our hate crimes and get whatever, but we got to come to focus on that. And so I just threw that on the table. You guys can welcome to call in and comment on that one, but we'll get into the what is it like being a black police officer in today's climate? For me, I don't really worry. I haven't really changed that much. You know, I try to stay out there and visible and help them when I can. But it's like the culture forces you through peer pressure to surrender into a climate and leave your culture behind. All of us in our jobs, who we are is part of how we do our jobs. No matter, you can't really write a bunch of directives and rules to get that out. Who I am is going to transfer out in doing my job. And if you're in a profession where that's frowned upon, we don't want that Hispanic side of you coming out until we need a Spanish speaker. Then we'll pay you even money to speak Spanish. We don't want that Asian side coming out until we need it. We don't want that black side coming out until we need it. And I think that the public expects the police officers to be a part of the community, you know, be able to go in there and relate. And I think all too often, sometimes, especially when I look at the shootings that are going on and a lot of the neighbor problems that are facing, particularly the black community, you see by and large a silence of active working black officers. You don't see them speaking up in regards to some of these shootings. Now, that's not to say you have to do what I do. You know, to each his reach, and if I don't cop it, it's not mine to have. But, you know, when you take that uniform off, you look just like everybody else. You look like Alton Sterling. You look like Tamir Rice. You look like Terrence Crutcher. And some of this stuff should alarm you, because when you go back into the neighborhood, even if the shooting is 20 states away from you, the community is looking to you to see how you feel about it. What do you think about it? You know, do you agree with it? And oftentimes they're met with, well, I don't want to say nothing about it, but we'll say something about everybody else's business. That is one of the things that makes the community detached from you. Even as a black officer, they will leave you out there. You know, if you see them going through something and you know the way the problem is being approached isn't going to work, why don't you step in and say, hey, whoa, you know what, let's try this with this community. Have we talked to this community? And stop leaving it up to people just because they have a position. That doesn't necessarily qualify them to be able to deal with that demographic. You know, I don't speak Chinese. I can't go into a Chinese neighborhood and think I understand those people. That's the biggest problem with policing, is an inability, an unwillingness, and a lack of desire, period, to really go in as a profession. So, officers, don't be getting your feelings hurt. I'm not talking about any individual. But as a profession, we will not go in and learn other cultures. We will not go in and learn why some cultures won't look you in the eye. It doesn't mean that you're guilty of anything. It means that that's part of their culture. You know, if you go into most black neighborhoods, black people, we will talk loud. We will talk with our hands. We will be animated. That's part of the culture in the inner city. And some of that comes from not being heard. And a lot of times in these meetings, you're dealing with topics that have gone unaddressed. You know, sad to say, you can go onto YouTube, and if you were to Google officers helping the neighborhoods, you'll see more individual white officers in black neighborhoods than you will black officers in black neighborhoods. And I'm not talking about the cosmetic, superficial, you know, give a kid a bike. You know, we got to get back to being part of the community. there in uniform. You know, if you live in a town and you don't know how many black officers you have and you're black, then either they're invisible or you're not doing your homework. It's one of the two. But we got to do something to draw them back into the community, and they've got to do something to draw them back into the community. I'm gonna get started on these callers real quick because last week I ran out on y'all, and I don't want to rush you guys. I'll go to 804 first, 8603. Good morning. You're behind the blue curtain. What's going on?
Good morning, Stan. It's Brother Gus calling from the 804. Hey, it's I think with black officers, man, we do have to be they do have to be more visible, and we just kind of as a community we kind of take them for granted that they're just doing a job and not necessarily part of the community, but part of an occupying force. So I do think, though, man, if they get more involved in the community, then I guess they'll be more accepted and looked at differently than, you know, the white counterparts.
You know, yeah, I mean, but they it's got to be genuine. You know, you can't just come into the neighborhood when you need a haircut. You know what I'm saying? And then, hey, brother. But then, you know, when you change back out into the uniform, I know black officers are going to be upset after this show. That's okay. They'll get over it. But, I mean, you can't do that. That's that mistrust.
Right.
You have to be embedded and part of that. You got to be there more than 9 to 5. You got to have some investment. Because let's face it, most of us that are doing this job, we came out of some of these communities. So we can't come out and then say, well, I got it all figured out. You got to get what I got. We deal with people at their worst, and most of us can understand and draw just an immediate connection with what they're going through because we've been through it.
Yeah, I know that's crazy. But in Washington, where I lived at in Washington, D.C., a number of years ago, it was pretty funny because the city is predominantly black. But the police force was really heavily white in the hood where I live. And I'm like, well, why are there so many white police officers here? Even though the force was pretty much evenly split, but most of the white guys were in the hood. And that's what I didn't understand. I'm like, well, why are they putting these guys coming from West Virginia, out rural Maryland, into the hood, into the city, and they're, you know, and they not knowing the culture. So that, you know, it's a problem there too.
Yeah, and I apologize. I should have got the statistics, but there's not a lot of African-Americans that are in policing as compared to whites. But, I mean, and that's for various reasons. Some of them are not always good in certain areas. But I think in policing, I know for me, it's you know, you have those that are going to go along with whatever the system wants done. And that's just what they're going to do. And that's cool. If that's you, do you. But then there's some that won't like what I do. Well, you know, you shouldn't be doing this or you shouldn't be doing that, man. You know, if you're not doing it, that's on you. But don't hate on people that are trying to make it. And I think that peer pressure, that you get enough peer pressure in the job, period, point blank. You get that automatically. And you don't need it from other officers that are black, when you get a black officer that's trying to make a difference, you know, and that the same thing now that I'm talking about with black officers, though I'm not a woman, you could direct that straight to even being a woman in policing because they catch just about as much hell as black officers do in many aspects of being a woman. And there's some parts of this job a woman can do better than a man. I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is, you know. But these are things inside, and Gus, you know, not even within policing, officer to officer, one of the least talked about topics is race.
Right.
That's one of the, even among us, and if we can't talk about it, how can we go out and serve that diverse community? I had a little rookie that just started, he probably first, second month out here, and I was proud of this kid, you know, little white kid, and well, not a kid, he's a grown man, but you know, he came up to me, and he didn't quite know how to say it, and he pieced it together. He said, how can you give me some tips on how to police this community? Man, I was so proud of that kid, man, because he wants to know. He wants to learn, you know. And I told him, I said, let me tell you something about the black community, policing the black community, my experience of it is. They understand that some folks are going to go to jail. You don't have the expectation of privilege that you have in the affluent area. So that's a big load off of your mind. I said, number one, if you tell somebody to stand there, they're going to stand there until you tell them to leave. If you forget to tell them to move and get in the car and go around the corner, they may still be there. Part of that is they're trying to do the right thing, and some of it is fear because of the history of policing. But, you know, I said, just be truthful with them. That's the biggest thing in the black community. Be truthful. If you're going to do something, do what you say you're going to do. If you can't do it, go back and tell them you can't. But don't tell them you're going to do something that you don't do, because once you burn that bridge, it's no good. And play the game fair. Don't set people up. Don't plant dope. Don't be one way and then get around other officers and flip around. People don't like that inconsistency. Be you. Be real. Because this game is going to be played when all of us are gone. You know? And that's the big, the black community, from my experience, is very easy. Even if you got gang members. One of the things with gang members is they're big on is respect. And I got one of my homeboys, OG, he's on here. We're going to do a show, and he's lived a life, and he turned his life around. But he'll tell you, the gang thing, it's respect. As long as you respect them gang members, and if you're playing by the rules, believe it or not, a lot of these people say, nah, Officer so-and-so, he's straight. Don't mess with him, and you won't even know it. And these folks out here will have your back, and you won't even know it. I'm going to drop down to this next caller real quick, Gus. I still got your mic open. And we're going to go down to the 414 area code, 0432. Good morning. You're behind the blue curtain. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good today.
Uh-oh. Here she comes. What's going on, Age?
You know, I like what both you guys are saying, but I want to point out that this is America. We built up a many cultures and backgrounds from all walks of life. So, therefore, we should already have that not common knowledge of what diversity is. And if you don't know, you should be out there learning it, just like you guys said. Like, that is something we are built on. It's America, the land of many cultures and many type of personalities. So they should be equipped. And the only problem I have with black officers is you don't have to be a stand. You don't have to be out here telling the truth, like, you know, standing your ground and you telling all this information and feeding the community information. What you can do is when you out in that field and you see something, intervene, stop it, or you take over. That's what we're looking for. You take over, so therefore we won't feel as if, you know, there's nobody that has our back and we're sitting here getting abused and beaten while you stand on the sideline and say nothing or do nothing. That's really what people are saying. Like, that, I mean, how hard is it? You, if you see the officer getting aggressive, then you take over. Oh man, I got this. Let me freeze them their rights, handcuff them, put them in the car. What's the problem with doing that? Like, I just don't understand it sometimes. Like, you don't have to be that type of voice, but you can be that voice when you out there in the field.
You know, absolutely you can, and that's the thing I'm talking about. It's that peer pressure. It's such a, you know, policing is a very closed, shielded. It's just a really rigid, closed culture. It just is that way. And if anybody tells you it's not, that's a lie. It is. And we know that because it's resistant to change. And a lot of times, I think the reason why more officers don't do that is because many of them go the first part of their career trying to make stats and numbers and impress people or promote or do whatever, and they don't really make a bond with the community. I was very fortunate that I had two commanders that got a hold of me when I was, you know, 1-2 years out the academy young, Claire Crook and Mary Crook, both of them white, both of them females, and they took me and trained me in community policing, which is what I did. And that, so all of my career was immersed in the community, right there in it with them. And what happened was that community really sees me as Stan or just Mason. They don't get into the whole Officer Mason or Sir, or, you know, and so they bond to you. And when they don't see you in a while, they'll ask, call down and ask, hey, so-and-so still working. But they got your back. And that can help you in several ways. If I get into a bar fight or I'm out there fighting with somebody like we see in some of these videos, if I can tell you now, if I'm here in Waco, there'll be some people that are coming help me. You know, until I can get some cops there, you know, there'll be people there that'll help me. And oftentimes also, you know, when departments feel like they just want to pick on an officer, or they want to do some of the dirt that departments will do, and let's go on and keep it real. Y'all know it, and I know it too. But when they see that community backs you, it'll keep them off your back. And that's what I try to tell a lot of officers. You come out and serve that community, let that community bond with you, because that bond will protect you. It will protect you. Because there's not as much loyalty as a lot of y'all think there is. There's a lot of jealousy in these police departments. You know, I didn't know if you wanted to follow up. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Oh, I do. I'm wondering if, you know, are we putting too much pressure on black officers, man, to perform a certain way in our community? I'm talking about from a citizen standpoint. And I think some of them are put in a position where, you know, either if they see something, they got to let it go because, you know, the man is out to get us, and so we get a free pass. I mean, you know, a free pass. So I'm wondering if that's some of the problems, too, in our community.
But, I mean, I can only go for me, and I can say that, you know, if you're speaking up on something an officer does and it's wrong, there are going to be officers – they don't have a problem with it. They may whisper you're a snitch or you're this or you're that. But what does that community think? Now, we're talking about maybe 200-300 officers. Out of that, maybe 15 or 20. Chances are they didn't like you anyway before you did or didn't do whatever it is you did or didn't do. But what about the 100,000 people out there who watched you see something that was wrong? And you don't say something right because you're worried about what the department's going to do. Let the department do what it thinks it needs to do. And you know what? If they're not right, get an attorney and light their ass up. That's what's going to happen. The citizens will back. I would rather say what is right and do what is right and speak up for something that is right than to remain silent and count among all those who committed the act. Somebody got a lot of stats. See who that is. Okay, that was Gus. I'm letting clear static up. But, you know, I mean, that's just the way I feel on that topic. You know? Adrian, do you want to follow up on that?
Well, I agree that I don't think we're putting that much pressure on black officers. We're asking you to be the voice when you're out there on the field. You don't have to be the voice behind the field. We have expectations on you because we are more connected to you. So when you start to disconnect from us and then you're seeing these things happen and you're silent or you're speaking up on behalf of these people that are committing these crimes, then we have a problem. You should, like Wisconsin, for a fact. I mean, well, it was a big issue a couple of years ago about what type of police officers are in the community and that the police officers should be should live in the community that they're police officers, but that they're policing. So they did have to do, I forgot what they did, but they did try to put more officers who live close to that those communities in there. But even then, still, if you're disconnected from the people, then what was the purpose of putting officers who live in that community there if they're not going to connect to the people or if you're not going to reach out to them? So I don't think we're not putting any pressure on them at all. They're sitting there standing behind the field and not really saying anything. So they're kind of in the shadows.
Amen. Let me go down to this next caller, Adrian. I still got your mic open. I'm going to go down to the 203 area code, last 41513. Good morning. You're behind the blue curtain. What's going on?
Good morning, my friend Stan. It's Charlie. Good morning to the panel. Great topic. Matter of fact, I stepped off a bus to the train because of the fact that I just wanted to get my 2 cents in on this conversation. Black officers of color, you know that they have, you especially, sir, you know this. You guys got an extremely difficult job to do. And you've been on the force for a lot of years. I came from a law enforcement family. I saw the pressures of what it not only did to their family life. Some went through divorce, some went through alcoholism. And the people that they're supposed to protect, and Gus kind of alluded to it, especially when you're a cop in the black community or probably the Hispanic community, any other kind of community, when people need you, then they call you. But 9 times out of 10, they're like, oh, man, he's a cop. They won't talk certain conversations around you because they think you'll run back to the man and all that. But people need to realize they're people. What I really wanted to ask you, Stan, we've got an event happening in D.C. next week, which basically brings me back to, like, the history videos of the 20s with the Klan marching down Capitol Avenue in D.C., or Constitution Avenue in D.C., white rights rally. When you have certain things that you have to protect, and I apologize for the background, but when you have certain things that you have to protect that you know you might not agree with the principle of the event, but you have to do your job, how do you get by that? I mean, with the officers that have to protect these guys next week, and they're even talking about giving them their own train to go to the event. We didn't get that going to the Million Man March. But how do you deal with certain situations, I mean, like that? And I'm going to step back.
Yeah, Charlie, for me, it's easy. As a matter of fact, probably about 10, maybe 12 years ago now, some of the people from Waco that are on here will remember this. The Klan came here to march, and they assembled down across the street from where the old police department was. And I was fortunate enough to get picked to guard them in the staging area. Now, people say, fortunate enough? How is that fortunate? It was cool because I got a chance to just one-on-one with their main guy. We're just sitting there talking, you know, because, you know, you always read about the Klan and you hear, but how often do you really ever get a chance to talk to one? So I wanted to hear, you know, firsthand what this guy's saying, where he's coming from, why they believe what they believe, how committed are they to what they believe, you know, so... For me, I saw it, and it's just based upon where I was. I wasn't standing on a line having to keep them separated and anti-Klan people over here. We were just in their little staging area, you know, and he kind of looked shocked when I come over. I said, hey, man, let me talk to you for a minute. And, you know, and he came over and he talked and, you know, and we actually picked his brain because I wanted to know more about them. And that was a perfect opportunity for me. So I didn't see it as a confrontational thing because he's there hoping he survives. I'm there getting paid. So why not get some knowledge from him? I mean, I don't agree with what this guy does, obviously, but to me that's a perfect opportunity away from the shouting and screaming. It's just us for me to sit down with this guy and find out what do you really believe? Not a documentary, not a book. I want to hear from you. What do you believe? What does this patch mean? You know, what's the history of your particular? I mean, it's when you get to talk to him, and I'm just talking from a philosophical standpoint, and you hear them, you learn. You're learning their tactics and what they think and why they think. And you're finding out that some of the myths that you hear aren't true anymore. The Klan has evolved, you know, big time. So a lot of it is how you look at them. I mean, most officers are, when you're in those positions where you're in between two different groups, a lot of times their feelings don't come across. I mean, you're there. You're getting shouted at, and you're getting, you know, angry. And most officers will tell you, these people aren't mad at me. They're mad at the city of Waco, or they're mad at whatever, because they don't know you personally. And then you also know that you can do one crazy thing or say one thing that can spiral that whole thing out of control, and a lot of officers get hurt, a lot of citizens get hurt. So, yeah, it, you know, sometimes it can be challenging, and, you know, it takes some effort. But if you get a chance to talk to these people, talk to them. Get that firsthand knowledge. You know, there were subjects in school you didn't like either, but you took them and you came out better for it. And so that's for me, that was the easiest way for me to have to deal with them. You know, I mean, I'm there like G said, you got a job to do. You know, you get there and do what you got to do, but have the opportunity. And I would say to anybody, no matter, you can hate the Klan and the Aryan Brotherhood, the neo-Nazis and all that. I'm not a fan of them either, but if I get a chance to sit down and talk with one that will talk to me, I want to learn. Knowledge is
good. No, you got that right. I mean, but there's certain areas, and I'm talking about Florida because I used to live there back in the 90s, where as a person of color, you just didn't go. Clearwater was one of them. Pinellas County was another one. It was a hotbed of Klan activity, and I don't know, maybe certain things because people, the economic change is going on down there, but it still seems like certain communities are still not benefiting from it. And with that, a lot of the police programs where these cops could go into the inner cities, the places where some of them might have grew up and everything like that, they've eliminated these programs. And I wonder, is that also a big issue too? because these kids aren't seeing black or Hispanic or Latino, whatever, officers that they can identify with. Because now a lot of these cutbacks with you have to hire a certain percentage of a different ethnic type. I wonder if that's also hurting, issues that you guys have dealing with our people.
Sure it is, because, I mean, we had a place down here in Texas, and for those of you that live in Texas anywhere, you know where Vidor is, V-I-D-O-R. Y'all can Google it. Vidor was Klan capital of Texas. You couldn't have paid me enough money to go down there and be a cop, period, point blank. You couldn't. And, you know, we all know, and let's, like I said, we're being real. Let's go on and be real about it. The Klan is infiltrated even in policing and in the courts. You know, they're there.
Right about that.
Yes,
you know, I'm gonna,
on
I'm
the
gonna,
jury stand.
Huh?
On the jury stand. You go into that courtroom.
There you go. Oh, yeah. You know, we can see that in some of the verdicts. I'm going to take another caller real quick from the 216 area code. Last four is 3111. You're on Behind the Blue Curtain. What's going on?
Hey, Stan. How you doing? This is Darrell Williams. How's it going?
Good morning. All right.
Wonderful. I'm listening to the show, and one of your earlier callers mentioned about the fact that it's a good idea to have police who are from your neighborhood patrol that neighborhood. And I'm actually an advocate of that. I encourage that for more police stations who have that manpower to do so, because for 10 years, I lived next door to a police officer who patrolled our neighborhood. And not to mention that the neighborhood stayed safe because on occasion when he'd take his break, he'd park his squad car out in front of the house. So the presence of the police in the neighborhood was always visible. And when certain things would occur in the neighborhood, people knew him. So it was easier for him to deal with them, for him to deal with them and vice versa, because he knew the community. He knew the bad kids in the neighborhood. He knew the troublemakers in the neighborhood. And there were certain things. Now, some people say those officers give other people more of a break. I'm not necessarily sure if that's true, but he was hard on the kids that were, delinquents and doing things that they weren't supposed to do. And sometimes taking you home to your parents is a lot more effective than just locking the kid up in the system, because you take that kid home to his mom. And to his dad, he's liable to be on punishment or, get his butt spanked or what have you, be put on punishment and, get his Nintendo taken away. And you know how electronics are to these kids being taken away. And it's like taking away their lifeline. So, it can be very effective if we have that in many neighborhoods. But I wanted to ask you, after making that comment, that statement, I wanted to ask you, where do you see other benefits of police officers patrolling their own neighborhoods in which they live?
Well, I can tell you, I think it's an automatic benefit. The biggest one is survival. Survival. When people know you and they're comfortable with you, they're going to have your back when you can't see it. The program that you're talking about, in fact, it came out in the 90s under the Clinton crime bill. And what they were doing is they took houses in transitional neighborhoods, which is a neighborhood that's not good and it's not bad. It's teetering on the edge. And they would get these houses, and the city would basically give it to the officer. There was no rent involved. He paid the utilities, but you had to live there. That couldn't be the side residence where you get with side boo and kicking. You had to live in that house, in that neighborhood. And I think it was, I couldn't remember if it's 3 or 5 years, but after that period, you own that house. Then you could rent it and do whatever it is that you wanted to do. That was a very effective program that came out. And because you were implanting a lot of officers who oftentimes come into departments and they're not even from that city. They're looking for a house or looking for an apartment. And here, if you're going to give me this whether even if I don't work in that neighborhood, I may work two neighborhoods over, but my house is in that neighborhood. So I'm now building a relationship with the neighborhood I work in, and I'm building a relationship with the neighborhood I live in. So you're really getting more bang for your buck. And the officers loved the program because it gave you a chance to get a house underneath you without having a house payment when you're first starting out.
Right.
But the problem we run into, now that's a good question, brother, because now let's go on and get real about it. Anytime, and this is just America, don't ask me why, but when you put programs into the inner city that are productive, that do lower crime, that makes that property not as easy to acquire, Then we come in with eminent domain and take it. Then we come in with gentrification and take it. So it's almost like sometimes it's counterproductive to a lot of residents, because when you get your neighborhoods fixed up, in some cities, certainly not all it takes is one investor to want to build something. The money under the table, a few side meetings, a few zoning changes, and kabam. You're out of here.
Right.
And we've seen a lot of that. I mean, you can look at Detroit. How did Detroit get from being a car capital to where it is now? A lot of it was gentrification, eminent domain, rezoning, and failed development projects, where you bulldozed people's houses and you ran out the stores, and then the project failed, and now you got people living there by project. I'm not talking about homes. I mean, whether it's a skyscraper or whatever. Now you got people living around skeletons of buildings in food deserts. You know, so I agree with you. It is a very effective program to have the officers there in those communities, and it's a good way to get the officers, you know, to live there. A lot of apartments do it. They give an officer a free apartment if he's just, if he's just visible on the property, and that impacts that apartment complex having them there. So the city should take it back.
And allow me to say, he was a great neighbor. Anytime I'm out cutting the grass or washing the cars or something like that, you know, we would carry on conversations about the neighborhood, and he was not only a great neighbor, a great person, and we need to acknowledge that in our police officers, because we hear about the bad apples so many times, and I think it's well due time that we hear about some of the good brothers as well. Thank you.
Absolutely, but it gives him, you know, living next to you gave him that chance to be a person and not a cop. A lot of officers are dying to get away from the blue, you know, to get that uniform off and get away from it. And, you know, it's nice to be able to relax and just be a person, you know. So, yeah, it's a very successful program, you know. I agree with it 100%. I think more cities should explore it today.
Indeed.
Appreciate you calling, brother. I'm going to leave your mic open here, and I'm going to drop down to another caller, 817 area code, last 42344. You're behind the blue curtain. Good morning.
Hey, Stan, it's Eric. How you doing?
Pretty good, Eric. How are you?
Doing all right. So this is a really great topic. I don't have much to add, really, to what you guys are saying, but I really appreciate hearing the different perspectives. But, yeah, we got to have cops that actually live in their communities. There's just no way around that you can't. I can't even, at least as a non-law enforcement officer, I can't see how you could effectively police an area you didn't live in. You know, it's just, especially with how many people, you know, we have in cities nowadays, this doesn't seem reasonable. And it seems like a lot of these cops that we have that are coming in hot and heavy on people are, they're not from the communities. So I think anything we can do to get that fixed is going to be a good thing. But going back to gentrification, what you guys were talking about, there was a study done. It was called the Broken Window Study. They found that even the presence of a broken window would increase vandalism, quite a bit. So the whole thing with gentrification, it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, on one end, you're making homes, apartments that are too expensive for black folks that live in that area forever to rent. But on the other hand, you are getting rid of some crime. So it's kind of a mixed bag, I think. One other thing, you touched on Vitor. That's a very Vitor's a very crazy place, actually. My dad went down there to work at a church, and he was told that if he didn't join the Klan, he had no future in that city, so he got the hell out.
Yeah, you know what? But gentrification, though, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I just think, to me, I don't see any good in it, because I think it's a tool, and, you know, you're not really running crime out. because what they usually do, they're not going to build these high-rise, expensive places that not just black people get run out of, even white people and, you know, middle-class people pretty much get rooted out. But trust me, they're going to get rid of the crime before they make the investment. They'll go through there and bulldoze everything down to the point of almost nothing. There's nothing to steal. There's nothing to do any crime with. And then they build up, and it's so expensive you can't get there. Then that's what we talked about last week, if I could just link back to that, is when departments will not allocate the resources to help citizens by fighting the crime in their neighborhoods, but then when the investors want to build something, we got all the resources in the world to bring to bear citywide to displace people or lock people up. You know, and so gentrification to me is nothing more than a tool like eminent domain. We'll just take it one way or another. It's just gentrification is a smoother process of doing it, but it's never been good to the inner cities and in any demographic area, whether it's the Asian area, whether it's the Italian area, the black area, the Puerto Rican area, the Mexican area. It's never been good. You know, you notice they never do eminent domain out in the suburbs. They never do it out there. They don't get around to it. So, you know, let's go down here and shoot the fish in the barrel. And it's not a color thing. Sometimes they don't care what color the people are. If they want the land, they're going to take it. But like I said, when you don't invest those officers, you know, and put them in that neighborhood, you know, how can you hire officers that don't live in the city? Some officers don't want to live in the city. Maybe they're country. Maybe they got animals. Maybe they got whatever. But the flip side of it, too, with the officers, think about it. If they got kids, do they really want their kids in those schools in the city they work in? When they arrest somebody and their kids are at school getting threats or your dad locked up this or they're having to deal with all that, that's with the officers I know that don't live in the city. That's one of their biggest concerns as to why they don't. I've got kids, and I don't want my kids under that peer pressure in the city I work in. That's a real concern, and a lot of us with kids ask yourself that question. If you go out and you arrest four or five gang members or, you know, you on a SWAT team and you do a dope raid on a big dope house, do you want your kids going to that high school where most of the people in that gang go to? So we got to measure that part of it too. And that's why I'm more of not an order that the officers have to be there. I'm more into, you know, give them some type of incentive to be there, like the free housing. Cynthia says gentrification is more about socioeconomic groups and power than absolutely. Absolutely. Gentrification, when they want it, they're going to go take it, and they don't care. But I'm more into give them a chance, you know, give them an option to live in that community. And when my city did it here, you know, in the 90s, it wasn't just for officers. They did it for teachers too. It was police officers and some other city employees and also teachers. The school district did it for teachers. So the teachers were living maybe not in the neighborhood their school was in, but they were right there in a neighborhood. So it was very effective, you know. But like most things that are effective in you know, the inner city, it goes away. And maybe it's because it's working, but it definitely goes away. When we drop down to the 203 area code, last 41513, good morning.
Stan, it's me. I'm just going to stay on mute right now. It's a little bit noisy back here. I'm just listening to the show, brother.
All right, brother. Appreciate you. All right, Gus, you had to get that background noise away. Okay, everybody's mics are still open. If you guys want to follow up on anything I said, feel free to chime in.
Yeah, well,
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead, Adrian.
So I was wondering, like, the fire department, they have these programs where they're out in the communities and they host, like, events for the community so we can get to know our community. Why can't the police officers do that? Like, if there's so much disconnect, why can't they just start going out into the community, hosting these little events, get to know the officer? Do you think that's something that's possible?
It's difficult in a lot of departments. Smaller, your Mayberries can do that. But, you know, your LAPDs, NYPDs, Dallas, these guys, they're running calls. They're busy right out the gate. Sure, they've got community service sections and different sections that can do it. But as far as the patrol officers, that are there? No. But now what would be interesting is if the city said, well, what we're going to do is, let's say on a day off for, like, the shift of guys to work with me, if the city said, we'll give you guys, you know, 2 hours of free comp time, let you get off sometime during the work week, 2 hours early, of course, not everybody, and spend 2 hours over here just at a meet and greet. Cost the city nothing. It's a good break for the officers. There's ways that you can do it, but the fire department basically, you know, they're sitting there in the firehouse cooking, sleeping, and watching TV till the fire happens. And they earn their money, but they're not out there running the calls. The officers are constantly. So there's some things that they can do that we can't, but that would be a good idea to propose to your department and see how it works. And if it's something they take up, please bring it back here and share it. You know, that's what we're about.
Oh, we have that in West Dallas. They don't have it in the inner city. See, they have what they call a SAFE program with the police officers. Department in West Dallas, where they host different events throughout the year. So you pay a membership fee, and that gets you into all these events that they host. But they don't have it in the inner city.
Yeah, most of the inner cities used to have a POW program too. You don't see that anymore either. You know, now we just lock them up, and it's costing taxpayers hundreds of dollars. You know, we used to have we did a deal here. We called it the Pig Bowl. And what it was, if we played the sheriff's department here, was a full contact football game. We got our equipment, got it from the high schools, borrowed their stuff, got our jerseys. Baylor came out, did all of our medical needs, taping us all up. It was full contact. It was aggressive. And I think we raised the second game, we raised about $10,000. And the school that hosts us, they get to keep all the proceeds from the concession stand. We took $5,000, gave it to a police department charity. Sheriff's department took $5,000, gave it to the sheriff's department charity. And I mean, we had about 10,000 people that got to come out and see us and meet us and watch the game and cheer, and it was great. But the city said, no, we don't want anybody hurt. We're not doing that anymore. So it went away. We also used to go to the elementary. No, we used to go to elementary school, about 10 of us, and we would play basketball games against the teachers and the students. And kind of a Harlem Globetrotters type thing, you know. And the students would all pay $1. It was last period. But the school, the class got to keep the money, you know. And the city comes back and says, no, because if you get hurt out there doing it, you're not going to be covered. So what did that make officers do? It drove them away from doing it. And that was something that was very – I mean, there are kids today that still know me. They're grown now. They're in their 30s. Man, I remember when you came to our school when I was in middle school and played that game. They still remember it. Officers want to do things like that, but politicians stop us from doing them. Well, somebody's fighting their phone. There you go. We got it. You know, so, I mean, there's good things out there, but, you know, and I know we say officers don't get involved, but sometimes some of that is not their fault. Some of it is politicians. You know, if you get hurt, you're missing time off, and city's got to cover this and cover that. And I understand their expense, but sometimes when you're making a difference in that community, we're spending enough money on crime, and if all we're doing is showing up and locking people up, that's counterproductive to solving the problems in the first place. You know, I think the administrators need to get out of the office more, and most of your police administrators, how many of them live in the city that they work in? How many of them live in the suburbs?
I think all of them stay in the suburbs, and I think all of them stay in the suburbs. None of them stay in the inner city at all. Not in what Milwaukee.
They don't have much room to tell the officers you have to live in the city. You know, I think the plan we talked about earlier, and I'll go back and find that plan because it came under the Clinton crime bill, where the officers got the houses in the transition neighborhoods, and they lived there. And a lot of officers took advantage of that. I had already had a house, but if I didn't, I'd have took advantage of it. And I was living in the middle of Hood Central, but, you know, I mean, nobody bothered me. You know, it was peaceful there. Somebody else had a comment they wanted to get in here? All right, I thought I heard somebody else trying to get a comment in. Gus, did you have a comment? I had your mic on mute. You had some background noise there.
Yeah, they call it up here a residency requirement. The newer officers got to stay, you know, pretty much in the precinct that they're patrolling in. But there's another program here in the city of Richmond, what they're doing now. If they tear up projects, if they tear up, you know, low-income housing, and they put a hotel or a shopping center or whatever they do, or any kind of upscale housing, they have to have mixed use. It has to be mixed use. It has to be middle-income and low-income incorporated into the high-priced apartment. So that's what they're doing here in Richmond.
They've done a little bit of that here, too, in Waco. I think, personally, it's been successful because, you've got that intermingling, and so people have somebody that they can actually see the benefits of, you know, somebody keeping their place clean as opposed to just cramming a bunch of people who some of them don't know what a clean apartment looks like, and you got 30 people living like that, you know, and it just runs down the area. So we've done that here, and I think it's been real effective. Our crime has gone down, and that was the same area that was one of the high-crime areas that we had. You know, of course, we've got some housing areas here that will probably go by the wayside because in Waco, you know, whether you want to call it urban renewal, economic development, gentrification, whatever you want to put on it, the city is growing, and everything's becoming expensive. And, you know, I don't know how much people keep track of here with Magnolia and different things we got here. Pretty soon, Waco's going to be to where the average officer can't afford to live here. If he wanted to, he's not going to be able to afford a house here. So what do you do then? The officers don't live in the city because they can't afford to. You know, or they don't, the teachers can't afford to. You know?
Yeah, Sam, can I ask something?
Sure.
When I was growing up, the job of police officer, obviously, it did not have all the problems that it does now. It was just you wanted to protect your community, be an example to people out there. My uncle was one for 36 years. But the police department as a career is not really as heavily promoted in minority communities. I know they'll go to churches, this and that, when the application is opened up. But I'm like, as a career, different departments that you guys have. Somebody said something about the NYPD. And, I mean, the NYPD is worldwide. No, they don't even really have to have a PR department. I understand why they do. But everybody knows about the NYPD. It's diversity, whatever problems that the city might have. But especially in our school systems and new charter schools that are popping up, I really wish that curriculum would come about. They used to give us tests when we were kids in high school, getting ready to come out. I think it was around sophomore. Maybe it's younger now. But where they thought your development skills were going, whether you would have skills that were more like heading towards a technical school, or whether, you know, college or two-year, just to get some kind of footing. But the fact is, I don't even see where we have those tests and those skill advanced placement tests. Gus, we were around school at the same time. What do they call those things? But anyway, it's just, I think if they did more in the minority community of not just, listen, if you become a police officer or any kind of civil servant, these are the benefits that you can get. You can get a good paying job. Obviously, medical benefits are very important right now. Insurance. You were talking about getting your own home after a few years, where for some kids that live in the ghetto, that's not even a thought. They don't think it's obtainable. But with certain careers, it's not. But it's with certain connotations, and people say, oh, you don't want to become a cop, and peer pressure and all that other nonsense. I mean, we shut our own selves down before we can really get started. And we lose a lot of valuable children that way, too.
We do, Charlie. But one of the factors with policing that a lot of people think, thank you, Rayshon. Rayshon says civil service exam, absolutely. But one of the things a lot of people don't understand or don't, I'm not going to say don't understand, don't think about because they're not in it. When you come into this job, you got choices you think of. Okay, you mentioned NYPD. No offense to anybody that works up, I wouldn't go up there and work. A, I'm not going to put up with that traffic. B, I like being able to drive to work. C, I'm not going to put up with the crime up there. D, I'm not going to put up with the interdepartmental corruption that's up there. C, I'm not going to put up with that cost of living. We can go on and on and on. So these are factors that you take in. Now, sure, some police departments will pay you a lot of money. But your chances of retirement without mental problems, alcoholism, being shot, being stabbed are very low. They're not going to pay you a lot of money if you know, they don't need you there. And then some departments aren't going to pay you that much, but the pace is slower and it's somewhere you can afford to live. Some people don't want to do this job in a cold climate. Some people don't want to do it in a hot climate. Some people say, I'd like to do it, but I don't want to do it there. There's a lot of factors that come in because we work weekends and holidays, and when it's raining, you go to work, and you got to deal with problems. There's a lot of factors in it, and, you know, I've seen a big drop, and particularly minorities that want to be police officers just since, you know, in the last, I'll say, 8 to 10 years. There's been a big drop. We go and recruit. I assume they do, and a lot of minorities just don't want to deal with it. And some of it is the negative publicity from some of the shootings that we've seen. And some of it is, you know, you'll hear people say, you know, they don't hear officers speaking up against it. So we shot ourselves in the foot to a degree. You know, I mean, we do get good black applicants. We do get good Asian applicants. We do, you know, but you're getting some people come into this job to make good officers that came into it because at first they didn't think they would be good. And those are where your best officers come from. The people that say, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm learning this. Because as long as they're learning, they're servicing that community, they're reaching out. The ones who come in and think, well, I got a degree. I got this all figured out. Those are some of the ones that you're seeing in these videos that think they know everything. So, I mean, yeah, we got to reach out more effectively, but who are you going to send to recruit them? And that's where departments got to look at themselves. What type of person are you sending? Are you going to these HBCUs? Are you going to the community colleges? Are you going to the recreation centers and the Y and sitting up? Do you require a college degree? I don't think you need a college degree to be a police officer. I really don't. It looks good. It's nice. But if we really look at it, the people running police departments in this country all have college degrees. And look at the mess the profession is in now. They may, you know, you can have a degree to be a chief, that's fine, but you got some good people out here that would make good police officers that got a high school diploma. You're going to send them through the same academy you're sending that guy with the bachelor's to. And that guy with the bachelor's isn't coming out of that academy any more smarter or ready for the streets than the guy with the high school diploma. You know, I mean, that's just hard talk, but it's real. Let me grab another caller real quick, Charlie, from the, let's see, the 818 area code, last 45722. Good morning. Thanks for calling Behind the Blue Curtain.
Greetings in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. This is Pastor Don Jr., CEO, and I am so glad you came to my line, man. Good morning to all the other winning team members and panelists. Y'all have been on fire all day. And I want to kind of hit on that. I dropped out of high school when I was 17, and I've been in business for over 20 years, and I learned more being hands-on by actually going through the trial and error of a situation as opposed to learning the book knowledge. Sometimes the book knowledge can have you going down the wrong situation because when you're live and you're in real time, they don't prepare you for the human resource element of that situation, especially if you're a police officer and everything goes in a left field within 5 seconds. And you came to one place, and here it is, people jumping out of buildings and looking at you funny and coming at you sideways. You need to have real live experience and have somebody that's been through that to show you how to handle that. And I guess my question to you, Stan, how do you sleep at night? Because a lot of times, I know when I have these conference calls and these ministry calls, I can't really cut it off. Even though I hang the phone up or I leave the office, it's still on my mind. You know, how do you, like, make the break? Do you take your work home with you? I mean, does the situation lead over to your personal life?
He no, don't sleep, I mean, at night. He works during the day. He sleeps during the day.
No, to answer it, I know for me, no, I mean, there now and then you'll see things that that you can't control, you had no control over, but you have to, you know, if you're one of these cops that you think you control everything, no, you're going to become alcoholic or drug addict. For me, I'm going in and I'm addressing situations, but you can't prevent what's already happened, you know, and you can't carry anyone else's cross because you got to be, you know, you got to be ready to go to that next call and know that I just left a murder when I come to your car. You know, you shouldn't have to know that. I need to be, that's just the hardness of the job. And a lot, and so at the same time to the citizens, sometimes when you say, you know, well, the officer was a smart ass, or the officer act like he didn't care. I say this to y'all. You don't know what he or she just left before they came to your house. Your big thing might be somebody's loud music next door. This guy just left a fatality accident where a whole family's killed. For the last 5 hours, he was out there, or murder, or whatever. So, you know, sometimes on both ends, there's patience. But you got to remember one thing as a police officer. One thing. You're not superhuman. All you are is just a person. You're not superhuman. You can't change fate. You're not God. You're in control of very little outside of yourself. You can hold your hand up all day, but if that car don't want to stop, you better be able to move. You can tell people say no to drugs all day, but you know what? Somebody's selling drugs. So, you know, we really can't prevent a whole lot, but you know what you can do? You can interact and influence and change by, not by your word. People don't care about your word, but by your example. Do you mean what you say? Are you approachable? You know, do people know how to get a hold of you eventually? Do people trust what you say because they see what you do? See, that transcends. Because all of us are going to hang our badge up if we live long enough to retire. And then when you hang that badge up, guess what? Next year somebody else is going to be 224. And you'll be a plaque on the wall. And the officers going down the hall will forget that plaque is even up there. But if you don't make a difference, if you come out here and do this job 25, 30 years and you hadn't made a difference in people's lives, you wasted a whole lot of taxpayer money. And took up a badge somebody else should have. That's just real. You can't come out here for that amount of time and not make a difference in people's lives. You can't help everybody. But now and then you get those calls that you go home and you can't sleep. You know, you see a lady trying to raise three kids with no refrigerator. And you say to yourself, you know what? I can say it's not my problem. Or I can go into my penny jar and my bank account, and I'm going to make my electric bill and have $25 for 4 days till I get paid. But that lady needs a refrigerator. The world don't need to know what you do. Department don't need to. Don't do it for the department. You do it because that lady needed a refrigerator. Kids with school clothes. I mean, you'd be amazed at how much officers do give. They just don't say anything. They just don't want any recognition. They don't want any attaboys. But, I mean, I've worked around plenty of guys. And I watched them come out of their pocket, $50 here, $20 over there. A lot of them. You know, I had mentioned my two commanders. I know both of them spent more money and time on kids than in their 30-some-odd year careers down here, than the people that worked the closest around them never even knew it. I knew it because they called me their son, but, you know, they did all this stuff for people, and people in the department never even had an idea. So the officers that are doing good things, they're not doing it to be seen and always out front. You know, they're doing it because that's therapy for us. Because we sometimes, depending on where you work, you work and live in a world of shit. And sometimes, in many instances, that officer is the only one in that neighborhood that does give a damn. And that gets old real quick. Especially when you work midnight. Because you're not dealing with a lot of, you know, kids and people sitting on the porch or whatever. And it's difficult, and it's hard on black officers. You know, do we need to do more of that? But we don't know sometimes how to get out of that. How can I be me in this culture?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Well, how do we measure success, and how do we put a value on it? Because you said a real key point. There are some unspoken heroes that go out there every day to do what they're supposed to do, and they never shine a light on it. It's like if you go to McDonald's and you get a burger, and they mess up your burger, and you don't say nothing to nobody, they don't know. But if you go back to the counter and say, hey, I need another burger, they'll give you another one. But if you get on the phone and your Facebook and say, man, I went to the McDonald's on 3rd Street, they screwed my burger up, now it's media attention. My point that I'm making is it's a lot of unsung heroes out there, but how do we value and measure the success? Because we are making strides. And if you look at where we are as a people, thank God for this internet, there's the unemployment rate is going down because more people are becoming entrepreneurs and starting their own home-based businesses from their computers. But the question I ask again, how can we value and measure the success of what we did get done? Because we're not completely losing. We're going in the right direction. We're here talking about it. But, I mean, what kind of value do y'all see, if there's any value there at all?
There's a lot of value. Particularly for me, how I measure success. I don't care about plaques and community awards and all that stuff. That stuff eventually is going to go in a box and, you know, your kids go through it when you die. You know, for me, when I'm out there on the street and I get some 35-year-old kid that comes up, and it happens almost nightly, oh, Officer Mason, you remember me, man. You hadn't aged, man. I messed up a little bit, but I remember what you said. I got my life right. That conversation don't have to go no further than me and that 30-something-year-old man. That I made a difference down the line. Don't matter if anybody else knows it. Because to me, what success is, if I'm fortunate enough to be able to lay on a deathbed with knowing that I've got a limited amount of time left in my life, I don't care about nobody else measuring me. But God is going to ultimately measure me. But if I'm laying on that bed and I go back over my life and my time of doing this job, I don't want to lay there and say, I wish I would have, maybe I should have, if I could do it all over again. I want to be able to say I made a difference in this kid's life. I made a difference in this kid's life. I made a difference over here. The world doesn't need to know I know. So that's when one feels success has to first come from within you. And then when you're out there and you say, man, that kid coming back to me made me feel good, so I'm going to reach out to another kid. See, and then that kid is going to grow up and reach out to a kid. So you vicariously live through the people that you help. And that success doesn't have your name on it, but everybody benefits from it. Everybody benefits from it. It doesn't have to be a plaque on the wall or a paycheck in the bank. That's the way we used to be. That is success. Jesus didn't have a bank account, and he didn't have a job, but we're still talking about him today. We're still talking about him today. But that's how you invest in people. I hope I answered your question. I can only say for me how I do it. You know, because I don't want to tell you speaking for all black officers. No, I wasn't.
Look, it's a lot of people out there that's working hard behind the scenes to make these missions happen. And a lot of times when people see the football team, they don't think about the person who gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning, who put the white out there on the line so that the football players can know where the markers are for the yards on the field. Everybody has a job and a focus on this mission. Now, it's not for one person. It takes multiple ways and teams of people. So it's not just on the police department, but we as a people have to police ourselves at home first. And one of the key things that is not talked about, without the father in the house, it makes it harder for the mother to police the children. And without having that 50-50 split, just like the chromosomes, the kid don't get opportunity to get the full-fledged wealth of life because they're not getting the full knowledge that they came into the world with. See, kids are real environmental. If you put a kid in an environment, and whatever that environment is going to be. It's like in a Jungle Book, when they put the kid in the jungle, he became a heathen because that's where he was in the jungle. But there are some kids and some parents, they might live in the hood, you go in their house, it's like a Taj Mahal, but when they come outside, it's like Beirut. But they have a mindset to work and stay focused to move out of that situation. So it's so many different variables and factors of the environment, of the neighborhood, it makes this thing, this topic so hot. And with black people being the smallest population, being 12% of the represented on the planet, but we represent 51% of the prison population system, there's a problem there. And the problem is we're not working together prior to us going to prison. And once we go, we're trying to put together the pieces after the fact. So I believe in preventative maintenance over absolute cure. You know, if we can wear condoms, we won't have illegitimate kids, and it's just simple as that. And it's small things making small changes that's going to bring forth mega change. My name is Pastor Darger, your CEO. I can be reached at 818-358-5722. I'm all about making change. We've been on over 1,300 podcasts like this, and the more we get on these shows, the wisdom is passed, mm-hmm. and we're getting educated from the people who's actually out there, like Brother Stan, on the front line every day, dealing with the community, reaching out to the people. As long as people keep reaching, somebody's going to see it and change will come.
All right, Pastor John, I appreciate you calling in. This time we're going to go to 203 area code. The Ace of the Bullpen, Mr. Tyrone K. Dunmore. What's going on, Ty?
Hey, what's happening, fellas? How's everything, man?
Everything's just good.
Just listening, and you know what I'm constantly hearing is starting off when you talked about the pressure put on police officers and using phrases like civil servant job and civil servant test. Well, the real test in life is to be civil and be a servant to humanity, to all people. And when you try to box a police officer just as a police officer and don't look at him as your fellow human being who's just got to do a particular job, I think that's very unfair. I also say that when these communities that become ravaged with crime, as they have a phrase in New York called Crime Stoppers, well, you know, you hate the police, as they say, until you need them. But the question comes about, and this is just a solution, stop committing so much damn crime. Why are people committing so much crime? There wouldn't be so much need for police to come to aid if we wasn't out there doing things that people are doing. And when the brother just spoke about success, one of the things about success is we have to discard what we think is success based on a European mindset. We got to go back to humanity, cultural 101 base. And that means forget putting places or putting a price tag on what we think is success, whether it's a car, a house, clothes. We're talking about these intrinsic values that was already placed in us from the time of our reception. I don't like to say conception. I know they use that in American or English vernacular, but it's really a oxymoron when you say concept, which should be a reception. When we came into being, there's certain morals, there's certain ethics, there's certain values that are already there. I mean, if we don't cultivate that in us, then yeah, we'll tend to do and become everything we ain't supposed to be. And one of those things is criminals, you know, the mindset, the Klan. When you think about the system itself, it's Klan-based. Let's make that clear. When you think about the order of the police and how that all started history, I know you know it very well, Stan. That had nothing to do with it. So the basis of all this stuff is, if you want to say, with the sheets on and the hoods on, so to speak. Now it's suit and ties. Now it's more technologically advanced. Now we have to be a little bit more savvy with the way we approach this thing. And if you understand anything, one of the things you should understand is you don't hate. I don't hate the Klan. One of the things I would do pretty often was go visit their website and see how they think, like you said, Stan, and get some of that, what they consider their mindset. I ain't going to say it's knowledge. Oh, it is knowledge, but it's not right knowledge. And they've been misguided, misled, and misdirected, so they have a misconception about particularly people of color and other ethnic groups. And fear is the basis of most of our violence. So they can become a very violent and very arrogant and a very hostile group because of fears. And the fears is because of information that has not been corrected by us in many ways. If you allow people to keep feeding people garbage, well, guess what? They're going to keep spitting out garbage. Because yep. Only thing that can come out of you is what really goes in you. And one thing we have in our human body, which I love, is the fact that we have this defense mechanism. When something ain't right, we'll throw it up. Unfortunately, when it comes to information, we don't have the same defense mechanism. There's a lot of stuff that's been fed to the masses that we should have been throwing up. A lot of things we've been using for centuries, we're still using. We need to throw it up, throw it down, throw it out, because it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked for us as humanity. And we got to stop using these fictitious numbers like 12% and 13% when you talk, and stop using these fictitious titles or classifications as minorities when you have one particular place. If you want to call yourself an African American, that means you're going to attach yourself to a place what they now call Africa. which of course is just another place where they divide and separated people in different ethnic and cultural groups, whether you're Somalian, whether you're Egyptian, whether you're South African, whether you're Nigerian, whether you're from Ghana, whatever, you still are separated. But what the point I'm making there is you have one country alone. Nigeria has 186 million people. So you tell me how in the hell we can be minorities on a global stand. We got to take ourselves out of this little box called America and get more global and universal in our thinking. And then we get more global. See, we'll get global when it comes to getting into entrepreneurship, because you ain't going to be able to really stay in business if you just stay local. That's why you have the World Wide Web. That's why you have these different tools now in place that we're utilizing for our benefits. But we need to benefit more on investing back in ourselves and creating, recreating who we really are and not falling stupid.
Uh-oh. He dropped off. He's making some good points. What we're going to do, though, we're getting down to the last little bit here. So we're going to go, everybody that called in is still on hold. Now we're going to that barbershop round. And this is where what we do for all you first-time people, when you call into the show, I keep you on. We don't hang up on anybody unless you just plain crazy. Then I might hang up on you. But we're going to go back down the line. And everybody that called in has got 1 minute. Any topic, anything that they want to talk about was ever important to them. And we're going to start with Gus up in 804. 1 minute, Gus. What's going on, brother?
All right. Thanks for having a show today. It was a great topic. And I want to say thank you to TKD for that very insightful commentary. Black officers, it's my opinion, black officers, I think they need to be more involved in the community and less involved in worrying about their status on the department. Just going by some of the officers I know here in Richmond, they really don't, not that they don't care about the community in which they serve, but they're more interested in what's their next level going to be when they get promotions or do that, as opposed to going out into the community and helping, our community. So, but give out kudos to all the black officers who are listening, man, who put their lives on the line every day, and the ones that really do care about our community. Big shout out, and make sure when you go out on patrol, be safe, and so you can get back home to see your families. God bless.
All right, brother, I appreciate you. We're going to move down to the 414 area code, 0432. 1 minute, anything you want to talk about?
Yes, I also like to give a shout out to all those officers who are doing stuff not only behind the scene but in front of the scene. And, you know, as a community, we do need to build ourselves up and also take that on the road and apply that to every day of our life. Like, every issue is important, no matter how big or how small it is. If I could touch one person out of 100, that's good enough for me, because I know that information will get passed along to somebody else. So get up in your communities, speak out, and stay blessed.
All right. Amen. Appreciate you. Thank you, young lady. 817 area code, last 42344. 1 minute. Anything you want to talk about?
Hey, Stan, thanks again. This is Eric. Great show we had. Appreciate Adrian. And I really wanted to echo what TKD was saying. What is it they – we have a phrase in Texas, at least, the snake's more scared of you than you are of it. And I think that really applies whenever we start talking about KKK, alt-right type people. These are like scared people with really, really bad information. And they're more scared of this progressive narrative that they see playing out, and a lot of it's based on conspiracy theory, to be honest with you. But if you go in and you dig into it, it's really something else what people will believe. I'll say that. But you look at these KKK people, you look at the alt-right, they're just a bunch of scared white folks. Like, they're really pitiful, honestly. We shouldn't sympathize with them, but we can pity them. And we can try to change that.
All right, Eric. Hey, brother, I appreciate you taking the time to call in, man. Tell everybody back at your group, I said, hi, we're going to go down to the 203 area code, 1513. 1 minute, anything you want to talk about?
Well, thank you very much, Dan. Dan, great topic. I just want to say, if you're a black police officer, white police officer, it doesn't make a difference. You're a role model, and you are out there presenting yourself as doing the best that you can do. But there are others that you could also be a role model to. Last night, I had the pleasure of spending time with my nieces and nephew. And the reason I did that is because they need a role model, and they need a male role model. Some of our youth out there need police officers, firemen, other people in the community as role models. But we don't look at ourselves as role models, and we still need to start doing that. Kudos to the brother that called in here earlier and his organization. But we need to take that just a little bit further. Our investment in our children is our investment, because if we don't take care of them now when they're little, we have nothing to complain about when they get older and they're not doing the things that they should be doing. So God bless them. I'm glad I was able to call them this morning. And, can't wait for next week. Take care now.
All right, Charlie. Appreciate you, brother. We're going down to the 818 area code. Last four is 5722. 1 minute. Any topic you'd like to speak on?
Well, first off, let me tell you, I concur with everybody else. It's been a great show, a lot of wisdom. Everybody really said a lot of deep topics. I want to thank y'all for taking y'all time out to make history. My name is Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the Entertainment Worldwide Network. We're working on a $4.5 million initiative to purchase 22 abandoned buildings. We're going to work with a prison reentry program to help hire the people within a 25-mile radius of those buildings that have felonies and need a second chance. We're not dealing with any sexual offender felonies, but if you bounced a check or got into an altercation, we want to give you a second chance. So please reach out to me direct, 818-358-5722. And, man, y'all keep calling into the show, man. The call-in number is 646-716-4621. Press 1 on your keypad. It's very imperative your voice get heard. We've been on over 1,300 podcasts, and every time we go on the show, we meet somebody new, and the world is being changed. So we just take it one day at a time, man. I thank you so much, Brother Stan. I really appreciate you. You have a great day. And to all the listeners, y'all keep listening.
All right, Pastor, appreciate you. We're going down to the 254 area code, last 48282. I'm going to give you 2 minutes because you're a new caller. Anything you want to talk about or any comments you want to make?
Oh, yeah. Can you hear me loud and clear?
A little bit loud. You got us on speaker?
Can you hear me loud and clear now?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. Yeah, this is Nick in Waco, Texas, Stan.
I caught
the tail end of the show. The information that I did hear, it was great information being passed along. We appreciate the service, you know, that you do here in the community. I was talking to Stan last night, and we're raising money for back to school uniforms for underprivileged kids here in Waco, Texas, and. You know, I was just telling him about what we're doing. The first thing that he did was reach in his pocket and gave a donation to the cause. And that is the type of impact. Those are the type of people that we need in our community, the ones that are know that people are have a good heart, they're going to do the right thing, and to support those things in the community. So, I just wanted to say, you know, thank you for that. We really appreciate it. The kids are going to appreciate it. There's a lot of kids that are in the Waco area that are underprivileged, coming from a low-income family. It makes it tough, and the kids shouldn't be, you know, held accountable for the situation that they're brought up in. So we try to do the best that we can with the little that we have, and hopefully, you know, the community, y'all hear this. We're over here at 2401 West Waco Drive, looking at that barbershop. We're selling raffle tickets. That'll be going on all the way until this afternoon about 5 o'clock, and we'll have the raffle. But on tomorrow, we're having the program to give the kids so far uniforms and things of that nature.
Brother, I appreciate you. And y'all, you know, I don't give plugs a lot, but I'm definitely going to plug this barbershop because these guys, either individually or collectively, are always doing something in this community for kids all the time. If it's not back to school haircuts, it's school clothes, it's Easter haircuts, it's reading the kids and while they get hair. I mean, these guys, I'm going to give them some props because they're always doing something for the community. And like I said, y'all know me, I don't do advertising and sponsors, but when somebody's doing right, we definitely going to blow them up anytime that they're doing the right thing. So I appreciate everything that you're doing, brother. You know, if I could ever help you, man, just, you know how to get a hold of me. Just let me know.
Okay, man, we greatly appreciate it. Like I said, anybody else that's in the Waco area or outside of the Waco area, if you want to just call in at the Look At Me Now Barbershop, or you can just come on over and purchase tickets or even donate. But we have a lot of kids, a lot of kids, a lot of kids that are going without. And it's just going to be tough the first day of school. Everybody have on the nice clothes, you know, they're looking good, have fresh haircuts. And when you come up from a situation from low income, it makes it hard. So we want to give those kids, you know, a positive start. And, you know, the little things that we can do, hopefully it'll make a big impact for later on in life.
All right, brother. Appreciate you. Hopefully these local churches heard you. But if you need me, holler at me. All right, we're going to go down to the 404 area code, last 46020. You're behind the blue curtain. You got 1 minute, anything you want to talk about.
Yo, brother Stan, this is T-A-Z. I'm just calling to shout out the show. I'm proud of
you
brother. Keep doing what you're doing, man.
Oh, man, hey, you guys, for y'all, this, when you hear the behind the blue curtain theme, this is the brother that wrote it for me. I mean, at the last minute, I called him. I said, man, my radio shows, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm trying to get this stuff together for tomorrow. Man, I need some theme music. He said, don't worry about it. I got you. All slow. And then, man, I'll tell you what, about 2 hours later, that song that y'all hear, I mean, he sent it to me. So this is a good brother. Good brother right here. Hey, brother, enlighten us on something. You got a free minute. I ain't going to take up your minute. Anything you want to talk about?
Hey, man, I just called you. I didn't want to take up the show. I know you're running a business over there. I'm not long-winded at all, but I support everything that you do, bro. I love you like family, man.
I appreciate it, man. Love you too, man. Appreciate everything that you've done for me, man. And like I said, that theme music's tight, and that's all you. Appreciate you. All right, brother. We'll drop down to the 843 area code, 1854. You got 1 minute because we're getting down to the end. Anything you want to talk about?
Good afternoon, Mr. Stan. I am very proud of you.
How are you?
I thank you so much for helping and looking out for the community. God bless you, and you keep on doing a good job.
Oh, wow. Thank you. You made my day. I appreciate you so much.
God bless you.
Oh, God bless. Thank you. All right.
Okay, take care.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Going down to my ace in the bullpen is back. Ty, we got about 3 minutes. Let you finish up what you were doing. You had dropped out. Glad you made it back.
Yeah, you know, I'm used to getting cut. I got some sutures. You know, I got my medical team here. So, you know, they hurry up and stitch me back. So I'm back in business. But being on the front line, everybody who's on the line, and I'm going to echo what I hear Stan saying. This is not about Stan Mason. This is about us. This is about everybody playing their part, doing some type of role to make this world a better place. Yeah, we talk about some hard topics. And, yes, we may have to, and like he has to, wear a bulletproof vest. In this business, you also have to wear a bulletproof headgear because you're going to take some headshots. People are going to say some things about you. Not only say something against you mentally, but they're all going to try to do things that's going to upset you emotionally. So I would say stay encouraged, good people. Continue to fight the good fight. It doesn't end. It's no stopping us now. We're on the move. We got to stay in the groove. We got to stay in the cut, so to speak. Don't cut nobody now. Just stay in the cut and do what we can do, again, to make this world a better place. And that one of those things is stop being so criminally minded. Stop putting all the onus on police.
Start taking responsibility for the things you either create or didn't create, because we are some very creative people, and because we are from the one creator of us all. So let's use that energy to continue to foster better relationships between each other, starting within our homes, from there going into our communities, going to our schools, our neighborhoods. Do what we can, because Stan can't do it by himself. It's a team effort. Together, everybody will always evolve more and will inquire more as far as knowledge, wisdom, hopefully not just an understanding, but overstand, like they have the overseer. Let's overseer the safety and the health and the well-being of one another. And yes, sometimes you're going to hear something that might hurt a little feelings. But just like I got cut, I got sutured back up, I got my stitches, I'm back in business. So don't be discouraged by people who try to discourage you, us all, from making this world a better place. Take a global stance. Don't just take a local. I mean, we're going to work in our local communities. Remember, we're in a sick world, and we need more doctors. We need more doctors. So help out, and we don't need more medication. We definitely need more mediation, but we don't need no more medication. We got enough drug problems in this country. We got enough opiates and all the other things. Let's face the hard topics, and let's ease our way into the next generation. And when I mean ease it, it don't have to be as hard as we're making it. Lighten up, people.
Amen.
As serious it is, we'll have some little laughter with it sometime. Anybody knows me on the sidebars, I'm working on my comedy skits as we speak. We do some comedy as well. So, you know, keep your head up, man. Keep it positive and keep it moving. Thanks again for joining us on Behind the Blue Curtain with our host, Mr. Stan Mason. Thanks, Stan.
All right, Ty. Appreciate you, brother. We're getting ready to get out of here. Just to let you guys, just a reminder, every show is different. Like Ty said, we talk the hard topics, the hard subjects, but you know what? It's equal opportunity. It's all done out of love, because really, when you get down to it, there's only one race, and that's the human race. There's only one race. So if we can all just remember that, and just take care of each other, you guys. Going out there tonight, don't drink and drive. Don't drive and drink. Don't get into it with the side boo at 4 o'clock in the morning and make me have to come to your house, you know, when I'm trying to get home. So just take care of each other. And appreciate all you guys being patient with the website. If you get a chance, stanmason.com. Check out this new website. You know, Pierre Starr, my manager, he did 90% of the work on it. That website is off the chain. He made me look good on there. So I appreciate you guys. My big sister Cynthia's on. Love you, sis. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to everybody. And you guys be careful. We'll holler at you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please sit back, because you are now about to go behind the blue curtain. Yeah.